All right. This is week three of 2nd Isaiah. I was told by a couple of people who love me enough to be honest that last week was a little dry. This week may be a little dry too. Yeah. It's wet outside, that's right, and balance out. The hinge, for those of you that's first time in class because you've been teaching other places, the hinge for this whole study of 2 Isaiah is a claim in the New Testament from 2 Timothy 3:16, all scriptures breathed out by God and is useful for us. And the point of that hinge for us is not to argue about what it means for things to be inspired, which is what we usually do. The point that we're using that hinge for is because Scripture applies to us. So stuff that was written in the Old Testament has power for us. We're claiming that, we're believing it, we're using it, and we're trying to put ourselves into a mindset to read Isaiah, or 2nd Isaiah as we're calling it, in a way that will change us, that will connect with us deeply and change us. So we're doing this introductory stuff in Isaiah. Some of it's kind of dry. We'll try to make it less dry. But the first week, we set up the framework for the class where we talked about why it's hard to read Isaiah sometimes because, thank you, pronouns change unexpectedly. You think you understand what's being referred to as he and what's being referred to as I, and then in the very next verse, it all gets thrown up in the air and you have to start over again. We talked about how Isaiah is a collection of songs, in a sense, that are strung together. And Isaiah was a prophet for, his ministry was at least 50 years, had a lot of sermons or songs during that time frame. And the book of Isaiah is a collection of those that are just kind of put back to back to back to back. But they've been arranged in a way, not necessarily chronologically, but in a way that tells a bigger story than each of the individual songs does on its own. We talked about that the first week. Second week, we talked about why 2nd Isaiah. And Stuart was disappointed that I didn't get kicked out of the church when we talked about this. He was looking forward to that. But we talked about why lots of, this was last week, why lots of people think the back half of Isaiah was written by someone different than the first half. And maybe the back half was written by multiple people. We looked at why, some of the reasons why they think that. And then we looked at some of the reasons why people believe there was just one author. And the point of that, the main point for this class was one of the huge features of Isaiah that throws us off is when we're reading and we get to 39, chapter 39, and we move into 40, it's more than just pronouns that change. It's like it's a whole new book. And the first half, and the reason is the first half of Isaiah, 1 through 39, was written about things that happened 150 years before the stuff in the back half. And we used the example last week. It's like the first half of Isaiah was written about presidents Madison through Lincoln, and then the back half was written about President Obama. And there was a huge gap in between. So it throws us off that we don't understand that when we're reading Isaiah. So we need to understand there is a cliff, there is a chasm, there is a jump that happens between 39 and 40. That helps us understand it. That puts one of the things aside that makes us go, oh, I just don't get this. Well, now we get it a little bit better. The secondary purpose of last week was about that whole inspiration thing. What are the things you hold on tightly to and what are the things you hold on loosely to? Because there is room for people to, I'm not going to be mad at anyone that thinks multiple authors wrote different parts of Isaiah. It's not a hill to die on. The fact that it's inspired, yes, that's a hill to die on. Multiple authors, not necessarily. But that was a secondary point. This week, we're talking about the context of pagan idolatry. That's when we have our friend here, Marduk, or Marmaduke, as Mandy likes to say. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then next week, we're going to talk about the five audiences of Isaiah. That's the introductory part of the book. The intent, once we get through all that stuff, as I've been saying, is to have enough of a background, enough of an understanding of the stuff that throws us off in this book so that we can read big chunks of it in class together and let the Holy Spirit do his thing. and then we'll see together what's happening. Okay? But we'll have the context of what we need to not be thrown off. So that will be the fifth week of class when we'll start actually in the text of Isaiah itself. And after that, I don't intend to do much introductory stuff. There'll be a little bit each week just to set the context, but then we'll read two or three chapters out loud, and we'll talk about it, which is probably a different way of doing Isaiah than you may have done before. And as I've said before, it may... I don't expect it to fail. I think the Holy Spirit's going to do something through that. But it's a little bit risky. We'll see what happens. So this week, context of pagan idolatry. So why is this important? Well, if you've been reading through Isaiah, you've seen that this comes up a lot. This is one of the big themes that's repeated all through the book, especially in 40 through 66, is Israel struggling with what to do with these pagan idols. And it's not just Isaiah, though. It's the whole Old Testament. I mean, there might be exceptions. You don't see a lot of that in Ruth. You don't see a lot of that in Esther or Job, Song of Songs, or maybe Ecclesiastes. But most of the rest of the Old Testament, this is a huge thing. Genesis 1, we talked about when we talked about Genesis, this was a big deal. This was the context that the ancient Israelites understood Genesis 1 in. It's in that context of all these other ancient gods and what they believed, how they believed the world worked. So Genesis 1 to them, you know, it wasn't an answer to Darwin. Darwin hadn't been born yet. It was an answer to how does the world work, all these pagan gods. So that's part of it. It's understanding the context for what they struggled with. But then going back to that, all scriptures inspired, if so much of the Old Testament is about struggles with pagan idolatry, well, that applies to us. How do we make the connection? What's the connection for us? Because if we can bridge, you know, we'll talk about this in a second, we kind of hold that whole idolatry thing as cute little fictional stories. If we can bridge into the reality of their experience of it, then we can understand how the Old Testament applies to us, Isaiah especially, but all the Old Testament. So it's important for that. And that's part of the reason we're going to do it for this class. So, let's just jump in. Our default view, we talked about this a little bit last week, our default view of idols is the Clash of the Titans movies, or the Percy Jackson movies. You know, cute fictional stories of these kooky gods who have all these, you know, stories that are interesting to learn about. And we kind of view people who lived in the times when these were the default religions, we view those people as either viewing those gods the same way we do now, fun little stories, or we view them as people who were too primitive to know better. Both those views are wrong. Both those views are wrong. So we've got to start by setting aside a little bit of cultural arrogance and modern arrogance, because that puts distance between us and the original audience of Isaiah. And God says there's not that much distance between us. You know, we're struggling with the exact same things they did. We just call it different things. So we've got to close that gap by putting aside those prejudices. So we have to remember that Isaiah's audience was pre-science. The roots of our science were in the Greeks, largely. There were other roots in there as well. But the biggest root for our view of how the world works comes from our Greek heritage and background. But that was before, that was after the stuff in Isaiah happened. It was after most of what happened in, all of what happened in the Old Testament. The Greeks came after. They were just looking for how the world worked. And the gods gave them something that worked for them. their questions were the same as ours. What explains all this? What works? What do I need to do to be able to survive and thrive? What explains it? What should I be doing to keep my family fed? They had this need, the same that we do, this need for security in the midst of chaos. And they were looking for something to hold on to provide that security. In this context, these pagan idols provided that, which we'll talk about in just a second. So how did the idolatry narrative work? Well, I believe its roots were in some of the things that we see today. Pattern recognition is something that as a mathematician I like to talk about, like to think about. But part of the reason it applies here is that it's how our brains are wired. So I was trained as a mathematician. I work in marketing now. I use pattern recognition to make you buy things you don't want to buy. That's my job. Or make you choose a school to go to that you wouldn't necessarily choose. Because our brains are all wired to recognize patterns, even when patterns aren't there. So a pattern can emerge. When we did the Genesis 1 study, we talked about my drive in on I-65 every morning to work. So I drive in rush hour traffic, I-65, from Brentwood to Harding Place. And over the course of 9 years of making that drive every workday morning, I had built up the strong impression, belief, that if you have a Lipscomb sticker or Alabama tags, you're going to cut me off in traffic. Okay? And I hadn't intentionally come to that conclusion, but in driving up, that pattern had emerged and it had formed an impression on me. Okay? Now, 2 or 3 years ago, and this is just insight into the geekiness of the way I work sometimes, I was driving in, I started thinking, I wonder what it is about Lipscomb people that make them bad drivers. Is it that Lipscomb attracts bad drivers, or does Lipscomb somehow create bad drivers? I was thinking this through. And I realized, well, it's neither. It's pattern recognition. It's a false pattern. All these people are driving up I-65. There are a couple of, lots of Lipscomb people go up to Harding to go to work. Lots of Alabama people are coming up 65 to work in Nashville. That's one of the things that stands out in all the traffic. But Lipscomb and Alabama people aren't any worse than any other drivers. For all the other drivers, there wasn't a pattern. There wasn't data that supplied, that verified the pattern. So, pattern recognition. Another way this shows up is sometimes Mandy will say, every time I wear this shirt, I spill something on it. And you may have experienced that too. Every time I do this, this happens. Well, the way our brain works, it happens a couple of times, and we notice, hey, I've got salsa on this light-colored shirt. But the four other times when nothing happens, it doesn't support the pattern. Our brain rejects it. It's not a data point that sticks. But the two or three times over the course of time, you know, over maybe several years, once your brain senses a pattern, it looks for data that reinforces the pattern, and it ignores data that doesn't support the pattern. That's just the way our brains work. So here's an article from the New York Times yesterday. If it works, tennis players stick with it, whatever it is. When Andre Agassi peered into his bag before his first match of the 1999 French Open, he was missing one crucial item, underwear. He turned down his coach Brad Gilbert's offer to lend him a pair, then won the match. Agassi had lost in the first round there the previous year, so he credited the change in fortune to the change in attire. He did not wear underwear in the next round or the next, all the way through to his fourth Grand Slam title. Athletes are often superstitious. Baseball Hall of Famer Wade Boggs ate chicken before every game, and the Nets' Jason Terry sleeps in the uniform shorts of the next opponent. So this article then goes on to name lots and lots of little athletic superstitions that people have. Always stays in the same hotel room when in New York. Doesn't touch a razor when he's winning. Always step on the court first with my right foot. Started each day watching Teletubbies. Here's this quote. Every moment of a tournament was rife with managing superstitions and rituals. At times, I could tell myself it wasn't real. The need for these was just in my head, but I wouldn't really believe it. Serena Williams ties her shoes exactly the same way before each match. She wears the same pair of socks throughout a tournament and will not wash them as long as she is winning, even in a two-week tournament. scares them off. This might all seem trivial, Tracy Austin says, but players are seeking consistency in a world of unknowns. There's so much you can't control. The score keeps ticking away. The match has a lot of moving parts, and there's nobody there to calm you down. So if there's any one thing you can control, it brings you comfort, and that comfort gives you confidence. And that is how this all starts. Okay? This was written yesterday. So if you go back to the ancients, there were some very human characteristics in nature. There's great regularity. The sun rises, the sun sets every day. The moon, over the course of a month, does the same thing. The stars move through the same patterns over the course of a year. Seasons, where things grow and where things die. Death and life. There is very orderliness to nature. And the ancients saw the orderliness and wondered where it came from. There are also times when nature goes berserk. Tornadoes, floods, natural disasters of any kind, drought. What makes that happen? So, over the course of time, last time there was a drought, I did this and it rained. Last time there was a storm, I did this, and we had no storm for the next year. So you should do it too. Over time, these superstitions built into rituals and traditions, and these forces of nature were given personalities because they seemed very human. The regularity of it seemed human. So they reasoned from what they saw in nature, and they looked at the patterns they saw, and they gave them human traits because there seemed to be emotions. But, some days are bright, sunny, and happy. Other days are dark and moody and brooding. You can easily assign human characteristics to things in the weather around you. And they did. So what you had was this rising up of these views of how the world worked. We're going to talk about the traits of these religions, and then we're going to compare them to what you see in Isaiah and in the Old Testament. So one of the traits of all pagan religions that I know of is many gods, polytheism. There is a god that is the sun or controls the sun. There is a god that is the moon or controls the moon. There's a god of death. There's a god of passion. There's a god of fertility. There are about 13 things that in every polytheistic religion, those 13 things are at the top of the pantheon. Those are some of them, and they relate to what we see in nature around us. The gods in all these religions were human in every respect, but more so. So by that, they had emotions. They were fickle. They were worried about what someone else was doing, what the other gods were doing. They were afraid. They were angry. Even in us looking back on the Greek and Roman myths that we're more familiar with, we see that fickleness and that hyper-saturated human emotion. They're human, but more so in all of them. They have gender. Their humanness includes gender. And they have no purposes different than what human beings have. They're all about survival. They're about dominance, comfort, and pleasure. When you see them talking about the gods, those are the things the gods were concerned about. they were represented in human cultures with images. So Marduk was represented in Babylonia with the walking snake, which is what the Myers family has created for us. It's supposed to look like it's been dug up from an archaeological dig, which I think they did a great job of. But this is, we're going to use this in our class when we actually get into Isaiah. But there were images of the gods. Typically, they had human form, but sometimes they were things like this, or a walking snake. There are also images of Marduk as a person. There's this element of continuity. Which is a little strange to us and hard to get our minds around. But there is a oneness in the pagan religions between human beings, nature, and the divine. There was a connected circle. Where everything was in essence one. So that things that look the same are the same. Okay? So if you tie that back to this images thing, if I have an image of Marduk, it is Marduk, and Marduk is the image. Okay? There is a continuity between those. And the images were all made from, often made in human likeness, often, always made from wood or metal or stone, and made to be something divine. So that three connection, human, divine, and nature, was always in the image as well. So that means that anything done to an image of Baal or Marduk was done to that god. Okay? Continuity means that. It's not the way we think, but it's the way they thought. So that Gideon story that we talked about last week, where Gideon goes and tears down the Asherah pole and the Baal statue, and everyone's up in arms. Well, they're up in arms because he's done this to Baal. He's done this to Asherah. And all these people depend on those gods for whatever those gods supply in their lives. And they're going to kill Gideon because he's put their families at risk. Not because they're mad at him for tearing down some funny little idol. In their minds, he's put their very existence at risk by what he's done. And the end of that story is Gideon's father says, let Baal contend. If you know, Gideon tore down the statue, let Baal answer. And of course, Baal doesn't answer. So, but that, again, points to that continuity. If Baal and the image are one, then let Baal contend. Let Baal come back. He was saying that. Yep. So, an example of this continuity. If there is a drought, well, there are gods who are in charge of that kind of stuff. And there is a sky god, and there is a god of the earth. And in all ancient religions, the source of everything was sexual behavior. You know, life came from sex. That's the way it worked. So if there was a drought, if rains weren't coming, it was because the gods weren't doing what they were supposed to. They weren't having intercourse. They weren't doing what they were supposed to do. The sky god and the earth god were not getting together. So because of this continuity thing, what I do doesn't cause the gods to do something. If I'm doing it and I'm one with the gods are doing it. So there's where you get ritual prostitution, temple prostitution. That's not just a huge party, although I'm sure they enjoyed it. They were doing something very specific to guarantee their livelihoods. So if a worshiper and a prostitute are uniting, the gods of sky and ground are as well, and we can expect rain. We can expect the earth to be fertilized and things to grow. So you get insight into why they do the things they do based on the way that they think. Does that make sense? Okay.
mm-hmm. which really does apply to all of us and may create some deeper understanding, is these were success religions. These religions are all about success. They are about successfully controlling risk, successfully mm-hmm. increasing prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
Both. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, to step back away from that and to look at success as the defining rationale, the reason why the pattern recognition would have developed and become ingrained and hardened is that. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely a characteristic of all humans at all.
And today as well. Yep, I agree. All right, I'm going to keep going here. So another characteristic of this is that all the gods were in creation. So if there's oneness between all these three things, it implies that they're all inside the circle. You'll see that in Isaiah as we go. Because if they're inside the circle, then the God of the sun is bound up in the cycles of the sun. And the God of the sun cannot do anything new. The God of the sun can make the sun rise and set, but nothing new. The God of fertility can make things grow or not, but nothing new. You're going to see a contrast with Yahweh and the gods in Isaiah. These gods are in the circle and they're bound up in the cycles of nature. They're also gods of place. Which means my city may owe its allegiance to the god of the moon. And the god of the moon is tied to this city. And this group of gods is tied to this nation. When we read Genesis and we remember that it's being written to teach Israelites who have just been freed from Egypt, we remember that, and what they're struggling with in their minds, what God is trying to teach them. And you see a story of Abraham, and he's moving from place to place, and everywhere he goes, he sets up an altar to God. God is teaching Abraham, and God is teaching Israel that our God is not a God of place, which we'll talk about in a minute. These gods were gods of place. They didn't journey. They didn't go places with their people. They were tied to nations and cities. So, if my nation loses to your nation, then your gods defeated my gods. Which is a huge point for Isaiah. Because if Israel is in captivity, was Yahweh defeated? That's what they're struggling with. Was our God beat? Because that's how their world worked. If my nation loses to your nation, then your gods beat my gods. Okay? So their gods were gods of place. Humans were slaves to the gods. We talked about this in Genesis as well. So the Hebrews, the Israelites in Egypt, were slaves of slaves because the Egyptians in all of Mesopotamia viewed themselves as slaves of the gods, which was very convenient because if there was conflict, if there was something wrong with the world, it was because the gods couldn't get along and they controlled me. You know, it's not my fault. I'm a slave of the gods. All conflict, all wrongness, all fallenness in the world comes from arguments and fights between the gods. So, there was no single strand of ethics in pagan idolatry. Sometimes you were following this god. Sometimes you were following this god. Sometimes they weren't getting along. There's this story of Ishtar, Gilgamesh, and Enkidu. Ishtar was a female god. Gilgamesh was either a god or the son of a god. I can't remember. Does anyone? This is not important. Ishtar wanted Gilgamesh to go to bed with her. Gilgamesh refused because Ishtar eats all her lovers after she's done. And he saw that was coming. He said, "No, I'm not interested." His great friend was Enkidu. They went on this journey. They slayed this bull of heaven. And in the celebration afterwards, Enkidu ripped off a shank and threw it, and it hit Ishtar. Well, she killed Enkidu. So here he is communing with one god, but disappointing another. And he has to die because of it. You know, there's an explanation for why bad things happen. There's an explanation for, you follow that god, I follow this one. This one told me to do this, that one told you to do this. There's not a single strand of ethics to follow. They related to their gods through ritual and magic. They got their needs supplied by paying attention to the right god at the right time. So in the spring we do this, in the fall we do this. They were deeply, thoroughly convinced that this system worked. This was how the world worked. It was a deep narrative that they heard from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and passed on. And it got richer every time because part of it was pattern recognition, part of it was social pressure. If you don't do this, you're putting our lives at risk. We're going to kill you. So you better do this. This was how their world worked. And in their minds, it worked really well. It explained things really, really well. So if you contrast this with the Holy One of Israel, I mean, you can see the contrast right away. Only Israel and Christianity and Islam are monotheistic. Okay, so the one God is totally unique in ancient Near East studies. Okay, totally unique. He is other than human. So other, which also has holy implications, otherness. He is other than human. He is not human. He's not fickle. He's consistent through the ages with his people. The way God is described in the Old Testament is always the same. He's determined to bless his people even when it's not to his advantage. No images. He disallows, second commandment, images of himself or of anything. Part of that is because he knows images, that's how you get the gods to do things. That's how you become one with gods. That's how you take care of yourself. He doesn't want that kind of following of him. So the second commandment makes more sense when you put it in that context. He is transcendent, not continuous with creation, which means he's outside the circle. Again, that's entirely unique in ancient religions, that someone has a god who is not part of the creation, not bound up in the cycles of nature. And Yahweh is not. Second. He's not tied to place. He consistently said he's God of all nations. And like I said, in Genesis, you have him intentionally teaching Abraham and the Israelites, because the story of Genesis is told to the Israelites, that he's not a God of place. That as Israel wanders from Egypt into the wilderness and towards Canaan, God is with them. He's before them. He's after them. He's taking care of them. He is not a god of place. Everywhere they go, he is. And then the role of human beings is co-regent. It's not slaves of slaves. God has a high place for human beings in his creation. That also was unique in ancient Near East stories. So, with this, Yahweh has communed ethics. There is a divine single will for the behavior of humans. Conflict, fallenness, comes from humans not obeying God, not being in alignment with his character, not from the gods warring and fighting with each other. So brokenness in the world comes from the story of our relationship to God, not the relationship of the gods to each other. How do we get our needs supplied? How did they get their needs supplied? Not through manipulating God through rituals. All through the Old Testament. We're going to see it in Isaiah as well. God abhors ritual without the deeper ethical behavior that he requires. He says, you come and you make the sacrifice, but you treat this person poorly. I hate your sacrifice. Sacrifice doesn't change God. That's not the purpose of sacrifice. Like we say about prayer today, the purpose is to change Israel. The reason the rituals exist is to change Israel, not to change God. When Israel used those to try to treat God like one of these pagan idols, he kicked it back. That's not how it works. So their relationship to God, our relationship to God, is through ethical obedience. The Ten Commandments, four of those are about how we relate to God. Six of those are about how we treat each other. There are law codes in the ancient Near East. Those law codes that have some of these same things aren't listed as coming from the gods. This one is. God has said, these are the things I want you to do. All scripture is the story of God demonstrating love and mercy in the pursuit of his people. There's a quote. It's going to be too small for you to read. I'll read it out loud. Ultimately, the unique worldview of the Old Testament undergirds its claims of historical reliability. When we ask the Israelites where they came up with these fantastic concepts of one God, where did that come from, Israel? They tell us they did not come up with them. They tell us that God broke in on their lives and dragged them kicking and screaming into these understandings. They tell us they did their best to get away from him, but that he would not let them go. He kept obtruding himself into their lives in the most uncomfortable ways. If that report is not true, we are at a loss to explain where the fundamentally different understandings of life in the Old Testament came from. Because it doesn't match up with anything else out there. Other cultures all over the world that never connected with each other tell the same kinds of stories about how the world works. Israel was uniquely different. Where did that uniqueness come from? So, we're out of time. The connection that we need to make, and we'll talk about this when we get into the text of Isaiah itself. These were deep narratives for them. What are the deep narratives for us that we use to explain how to get ahead in the world? How do I survive and thrive in America in the 21st century? What do I depend on? Where do I hang my hopes? One of the things that I'll ask, and I don't expect you to answer, but who's better off? A Christian in Pakistan or an agnostic in Indiana? Who's better off? Because it's really easy to say the guy in Indiana is better off. You know, the way this world works, the way that we get ahead, the things that we tweak to make sure that we can feed our families are things that make that agnostic in Indiana seem like he's in a much better place than the Christian in Pakistan. But the people of Israel in this time of Isaiah found themselves being people of God in Pakistan or Babylon, as the case may be. And God said, you're better off than everybody around you. So that's where we're going. I'm sorry I used up the whole class time. There will be time to talk about this. If anyone has something burning they want to say, I'll let you real quick, but we gotta move on. Good? All right. Thank you.